This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It's great to have you with us for the Friday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto. The NFL ratings up, highest in several years. And we'll also take a look at the auto industry, what we can expect for the new year. Oil prices are surging after that airstrike against an Iranian general. We'll talk about that in our next segment. Right now, joining us with a look at the economic impact, Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, economist at andrewbush.com. Andy, really interested to talk to you, given the fact that you are not just an economist, but a political economist. I'm struck by how we have this happen. This general is now dead. A U.S. airstrike kills him. And you have the markets down. You have oil up, but none of it really significantly. I mean, these aren't huge movements on Wall Street.
No, they're not. But they are indicative of what the market generally does when there's uncertainty, especially when there's potential for further conflict in the Middle East. Obviously, they rally significantly. We saw about a half a percentage point in oil, actually a half a percentage point down in the stocks, and then several percentage points up in oil. And it's just part of an evolving narrative in the oil space. That's leading to the belief that there's going to be less production in 2020. A lot of the fracking companies are writing down some of their assets. Some of the big oil companies are doing the same. And there's a lot of stories out about how banks are writing down their assets in the fracking space. So all of this builds this story about less production going forward. And you got a pretty significant move in the oil markets, not necessarily a big move in the stock markets.
Now, when we look at what's going to happen, it really depends on where things go with Iran as to what sort of an impact it has on the economy or markets.
Yeah, and I think that's the key point that you bring up, because it's not going to necessarily lead to war, but it will lead to further conflict. And it really depends on what the Iranian response is. Typically, they go after soft targets. And that could be, like, if they go after something like an airline or travel, it actually could have the opposite effect on oil, where people shy away from transportation, they shy away from, you name it, anything to do that generate or that uses oil as an energy source. And so actually you could see oil prices go down. So it's really going to be dependent upon what the Iranians choose to do and how they are going to respond to the U.S. actions. And by the way, just as a side note to this, people are really incensed by this, and I understand the U.S. Doing this in a foreign country, but this is not the first time the U.S. has done this. You go back to the Obama administration, they actually used a drone strike in Yemen to kill an American citizen who was a terrorist. So we do have precedent for this before. Maybe that's the reason why the markets aren't reacting as strongly as they normally would.
Let's talk about a data point. Manufacturing weakening. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can kind of discount it because now we have a phase one agreement with the Chinese and reducing down the tariffs, and hopefully that's a path forward. It does show about the fifth month of contraction in this space, and obviously the rest of the world is contracting as well. But with the Chinese stimulating, cutting the reserve requirements at the beginning of this year, or just this week, I should say, and this phase one agreement, I think you can be a little bit more optimistic about what's going to happen manufacturing in 2020.
Thanks so much, Andrew Bush, former Chief Markets Intelligence Officer at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. You can find him online at andrewbush.com. Just ahead, oil prices are surging following the U.S. airstrike, the impact on gasoline prices. Oil prices have started climbing in the wake of the U.S. airstrike that killed a top Iranian general. Phil Flynn is joining us, Senior Market Analyst at Price Group, also a Fox Business News contributor based here in Chicago. Oil up right about 2.5%. That's a pullback a little bit from the high today. But what do you make of this number, Phil?
You know, I think you have to look at the price and realize that there's a greater risk to oil supplies than there was just 24 hours ago. And that's what the market is pricing in at this moment. I mean, if you look at the big picture, it's unlikely that there's going to be any supplies of oil that are going to be impacted by the strike anytime soon. But what we do know from past performance that Iran has had a tendency to lash out at oil infrastructure or oil tankers in the past when they are displeased with actions by the United States. You know, we only have to go back to last September when allegedly the Iranians masterminded an attack on the Saudi oil infrastructure and oil fields. Earlier in the year, they seized a British oil tanker. So the market is definitely on guard for Iran's next move, and that next move more than likely could be targeted at oil.
And 2.5% is the rise on oil today. The fact that it's not more, the fact that it's not more lopsided, does that just show how things have been spread out globally as far as oil production goes?
Absolutely. You know, the U.S., of course, is now the biggest producer in the world. We have a little bit of slack in the system because OPEC has cut back production. And if push came to shove, Saudi Arabia does have the capacity to raise oil supplies. But at the same time, Cisco, I don't think you can take this line down because there is still a significant risk of an oil spike if things go wrong. You know, one of the problems with a market can be complacency. And if you go into this saying, oh, we don't have to worry about these type of situations, well, maybe not the first time or the second time, but the third or fourth time, something could really have a big impact. So I think businesses, if they're hedging their oil, they have to be prepared that this thing might not be over yet. We could see some disruption to supply. So don't get caught, you know, short. You know, be prepared and be hedged because more than likely this is not going to be the last we hear out of this situation. There's probably more risk ahead.
Seems to be some challenges then for oil investors because, as we've been discussing here, you really don't know what the next move is going to be.
It really is difficult. And you know, the way that we tell our people is, you know, better safe than sorry. Protect yourself with options, especially if you're in the industry. We do believe there's some real value in oil stocks because they've been beaten up so badly. But at the same time, you have to really look at the balance sheets of these companies. There's a lot of shale companies, for example, that are in danger of bankruptcy. So some of these stocks can be very, very risky, but at the same time, there's great value. You look at some of the big money investors that are coming into the oil stocks right now, guys like Warren Buffett, guys like Jerry Jones, who owns the Cowboys. He might be busy trying to get a football coach at the same time. But anyway, he's investing big time, you know, in the long term of oil and natural gas. So I think long term, if you can look through the noise, this is probably a historic opportunity to position yourself in oil. But if you're worried about volatility, you better buckle up because you're going to see a lot of it over the next couple months.
And that's really, when you're talking about a commodity like this, if you're concerned with volatility, if you need to sleep well at night, it's probably not an area you should invest in.
No, you shouldn't. And if you're in that boat, you know what I keep telling people, don't try to be a hero. Put yourself in a good S&P 500 fund. If you want exposure to energy, maybe a little bit. But, you know, listen, the long term, it depends on your horizon. But if you're long term, listen, energy is not going away. I don't care what you're hearing about electric cars or you know, global warming. The energy sector is going to be here for a long time. Liquefied natural gas is a good long-term investment. Right now, there's a glut of it. But what I know from watching this industry, a glut today could mean a shortage tomorrow. And that's the way you have to look at it. It's a boom or bust industry. When low prices are low, demand will go up. And I think that oil and gas, of course, historically is low. So eventually they will start going back up.
So you have oil investors obviously paying attention, but anyone who drives a vehicle is certainly concerned about gas prices. And are we at a point yet where we'll see that reflected at the pump, or is that just not going to happen yet?
I think you're going to see a modest increase at the pump. You know, the economy is doing very good. Gasoline demand is at a record high. And so I think the consumers are going to see a little bit of a price increase, but it's not going to be dramatic. The key thing here is that the U.S. Industry is well supplied right now with gasoline. We had a weekly report that showed that gasoline inventories actually rose this week. So right now it's not a problem. If we continue to see disruptions of supply or if we see a military conflict in the Middle East, if we see the Strait of Hormuz, which is near Iran, get shut down, then it could filter down to higher gasoline prices. But right now, if I'm a consumer, I'm not going to panic. You may see a couple pennies up at the pump, but it's not going to be anything dramatic right now. But stay tuned. I mean, that can change. You know, if we see some more headlines or if we see some type of response by Iran, you know, all bets are off. But in the near term, I wouldn't panic about a big spike in price.
Thanks so much. Good analysis. Phil Flynn, senior market analyst at Price Group here in Chicago. Up next, a big win for TV networks carrying NFL games.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's been a winning season for the TV networks that carry NFL games. Viewership was up 5% over last year. That's according to The Hollywood Reporter. We're joined by Tom Lason, a media analyst based in Seattle, Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Tom Lason. Tom, so what do you make of these ratings rising?
One of the most interesting things, Cisco, is that this is actually the second consecutive year that NFL ratings have risen by about 5%. And that translates into about 16.5 million people on average per game, if you can believe that. And what I sort of attributed to is just some of the headwinds. You know, memories are short, and some of the headwinds that the NFL was facing have tended to fade away. Colin Kaepernick, that story has faded a little bit. Trump's call for a boycott. Worries about concussions, too many TV ads, they reduced the inventory a little bit, invasive officiating, rule changes that helped the offense. I think the NFL went into the back room, did its own X's and O's and made a few fixes, and I think we're seeing the results of that.
And that, I mean, it just goes to show you, people love the NFL, and so if you can get past those things, they'll come back.
Absolutely. It is one of the few remaining ways to aggregate a massive audience. And, you know, the networks are paying for that. It's a huge property. They're talking about this next round of negotiations when the contracts come up in about 2022, that instead of doing about, you know, $5 billion a year in revenues coming out of the networks, Fox, CBS, NBC, ESPN, in 2022, they could double that. I mean, you could see rates, the NFL rake in $10 billion per year in this next round. So football's momentum is continuing and just seems unstoppable.
But in order to do that, they have to continue this trend of getting more people paying attention, right? Because otherwise they're not going to be able to demand the money.
Absolutely. But, you know, the beautiful thing about the NFL is that they can always get that young male audience. I've got a couple cord cutters in my life, and that's the big topic in media these days, is running away from the traditional networks. But the workaround, they are happy to cut the cord with one exception, and that's the NFL. So that property is such a ratings getter. The inventory sells for $600,000 on average for a 30-second spot. The best entertainment show on TV is about $395. So the power's there, the audience is there, and the marketing piece that you've talked about is really getting some juice now when you get things like sports betting going across the country, fantasy football. Those things continue to feed this machine.
One of the things I've been fascinated by, and I think this is really them being nimble, the NFL being so open to streaming on their app. I mean, I'm pretty sure you can get all of your hometown games streaming if you're streaming in town.
Yeah, streaming is a piece of that. The feedback from the NFL and some other industry analysts that are pretty tied into this seem to indicate that really the feeling in the league is that the streaming piece is not ready for prime time yet. Yes, Amazon pays $130 million a year to stream games for the past two seasons, but that deal expires. So, yes, streaming is a piece of it, but it's still seems to me like television and the traditional broadcast networks are going to be the key going forward for a while.
Thanks so much, Tom Lason, a Seattle-based media analyst. You can find him on Twitter at Tom Lason.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Cisco Cotto. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. Help is on the way for social equity entrepreneurs looking to get into the recreational marijuana sales business in Illinois. It's Entrepreneur Friday, another solid year of sales in the automobile industry. News we're watching, fallout from the U.S. airstrike that killed an Iranian general. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 167 points, the NASDAQ down 38. And the S&P is down 15. Oil is up right about 2.5%. Cloudy day in Chicagoland. A dusting of snow headed our way overnight. Right now, 36 O'Hare, 38 Midway, and 36 degrees along Chicago's lakefront. Stocks have struggled throughout the day on Wall Street. Joining us to talk about it, Paul Nolte. He is portfolio manager at Kingsview Wealth Management here in Chicago. Paul, given everything that went on with the Iran situation that we heard about overnight, is it a surprise that markets aren't down farther?
It is a little bit. I mean, we recovered most of the losses that we've seen overnight. We were down well over a full percentage point overnight. So to be down a little less than a half a percent, it's actually not too bad. But it's reminiscent of what we saw when we had the drone strike on the oil fields in Saudi Arabia back in August. We had a 2-3 day decline in the equity markets. Oil prices rallied. And then things passed, and we got back to what passes, at least for the time, a normal market.
So if there is no escalation, then this might end up being a blip. If there is, then everything's kind of a who-knows situation.
And that's the big two-letter word. It is if, and we're still, everybody's kind of waiting to see what's going to be the retaliation and what that looks like over the next hours, days, or week or so.
So let's talk about then what an investor is supposed to do in uncertain times, especially with oil stocks. Is there anything attractive there?
You know, that sector has been the big underperformer. Last year it was up about 6%, but in the month of December it was up over 12%. So you get very short, sharp runs in the energy sector. With oil prices now over $60 a barrel, there's now a chance that we could see oil slowly make its way up towards 70. So if you're going to invest in that sector, you know, we'd look at the very large U.S. companies. They're paying 4-5% in the way of dividend. So if it doesn't work out, at least you're getting paid a nice dividend along the way while you're waiting for higher energy prices.
Yeah, and those companies obviously have a track record, so it's not as though you're gambling on something new.
No, that's true. And you're not gambling on reserves or trying to find new oil where you might with a driller or some of those other types of companies. So, again, looking at the very large U.S., I think is probably the safest way to play it, although we wouldn't be real excited about energy at this point.
So looking ahead to 2020, we've had a lot of people kind of skittish because we had a nice run last year, essentially saying, oh, it can't happen again. Really, does it just end up coming down to the fundamentals and what we see in 2020?
It really does. I mean, this last year, most all of the gain is because of the PE multiple going up. Earnings were really flat. The stock prices rose. So what you're paying for the same level of earnings is much higher today. The anticipation is that we get 10% earnings growth this year, and we really need to see that come through. Certainly with the Fed on the sidelines and maybe a diminishment in some of the trade war rhetoric, we have maybe a little bit better market for this year. But then, of course, we're all going to be looking at November and the election. So the first part of the year might be a little bit on the skittish side. And once we get at or through the elections, the markets can maybe move higher once we get past that point.
As I watched the markets day to day throughout the last part of last year, didn't seem like we had a lot of those really volatile sessions where things were way up or way down. It was just sort of this slow, steady growth. And if you look at the charts, that's kind of what we saw. Is that the kind of growth we want as investors?
Certainly, it prevents an awful lot of gray hairs for investors along the way. But I think really when you're looking at the markets, it's abnormal. We saw that in 2017 where the markets just kind of went higher. Volatility really dropped off. And then everybody got surprised in January of 2018. Normally speaking, we get 3, 4, 5 market declines of anywhere between 3-5%. We might get 1 or 2 where the markets drop 10%. From high to low. That's a more normal market, and I think because of the Fed is being involved here in the market and has basically said, we're not going to be raising rates, we're probably not going to be cutting rates, that's one of the things that's off the table that's allowing investors to feel pretty confident about putting money to work.
So earlier we touched on oil. I'm interested in your thoughts on the retail sector. Now that we're through that holiday shopping season, what do you think about 2020 in retail?
Retail did, I think, fairly well during the Christmas season, even though it was shortened by about a week or so. we're going to continue to see a shift to online. And that is going to be, I think, a continued theme as we go through the year. So, again, it will depend, too, on what consumers see in the way of wage growth over the course of the year. Last year was a pretty good year for wages. As long as that continues and the unemployment rate remains fairly low, retail should do pretty well this year.
So need to pay attention to consumer spending. I guess we always do, but especially in 2020.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been the part of the economy that's really done very well. The consumer is probably the healthiest that they've been in a long time. And as long as that continues to be the case, we could see continued economic growth here.
Thanks for all the information. Paul Nolte, Portfolio Manager at Kingsview Wealth Management here in Chicago. Up next, help is on the way for social equity applicants hoping to cash in on legal marijuana in Illinois. Entrepreneur Friday.
Money Talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Entrepreneur Friday on the Noon Business Hour. Help is available for social equity applicants seeking to get in on the newly legalized sales of recreational marijuana in Illinois. Joining us to talk about it, Seeky Ballard, CEO of Good Tree Capital here in Chicago. Seeky, appreciate you being with us. Just for starters, when we talk about social equity and social equity applicants, what exactly are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about a group of people who come from communities that have historically been over-policed due to cannabis prohibition. And distinctively in the state of Illinois, it also includes, neighborhoods that are communities that are economically depressed. And the state has a definition for who qualifies as social equity.
So that creates essentially a second lane, another lane for people who want to get in on the business.
That's absolutely right. So the state has carved out 50 of the 200 points available in the application for social equity applicants. And really the reason that happened is because the medical operators, who, by the way, are the ones who are permitted to commit sales on January 1st, they don't represent the demographic diversity of Illinois and certainly not the city of Chicago. But for all intents and purposes, that ship has sailed. And so I think what the state has done is tried to correct for that imbalance in the recreational dispensaries, the new licenses that are going to be issued. And so, the question that I ask is, what can we do to influence the composition of licenses yet to be issued such that, they look a lot more like the state of Illinois? The first wave of new entry recreational license applications were due to the state yesterday. My company understands that the state cannot grant licenses to people who have not yet applied. So in our effort to remove financial and technical barriers to entry, a few months ago, we announced that we were going to provide financing to 100 social equity applicants. So we work in tandem with the City of Chicago and World Business Chicago, and we hosted an all-day hackathon where we paired the applicants that we're financing with volunteer experts who literally helped them write each exhibit in the state's application. And so the attendees all left with complete or near complete applications. And, really, that's just what's happening in Good Tree Capital corner of the sandbox. It's really too early to tell how much we've moved the needle in terms of whether or not social equity applicants are represented in the application pool and subsequently represented in those who are issued licenses. And right now, we still have the non-dispensary licenses that are coming up. I have a message to investors. You've got to get off the sidelines and put a portion of your investment portfolio toward making loans to these companies. You will do great while doing good.
Now, when it comes to that. Well, I'm just trying to understand here. When it comes to that initial application process, is it important that organizations like yours provide help? Because you can get off the rails just with a few wrong things in those applications.
Right, right. In the state of Massachusetts, which is similar in terms of its composition and benefits for social equity applicants as the state of Illinois, when their licenses came due, they received upwards of 4,000 licenses or applications. But the state only declared 247 of those licenses to be complete. And of that 247, only four came from social equity applicants. So really, the challenge is ensuring that folks have the resources they need to submit an application. And that is not a trivial process by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, let's talk about the resources. What does it take, not even to get something up and running, but just that initial process? What kind of money are we talking here?
Right. So, I think the state did a great job in lowering the financial hurdle to enter. You don't have to have your real estate secured until after the state has told you you've received the provisional license. That removes a huge financial burden. So really, the financial burden is more of a technical one. So the application requires you to have a security plan, requires you to have a financial plan, all of which requires you to bring in consultants and experts and lawyers and accountants to help you craft it. You've got people out there quoting in the six figures just to help people put an application together. And on top of that, they want equity. So this is an amount of resources you'd have to put into an application that's not certain. So, that alone acts as a barrier, which, going back to my earlier point, was the reason we went out and said we want to finance these people and we want to connect them to experts who are volunteering to help them write their application.
And how do you move forward then if you get several of these candidates who are actually eventually awarded licenses? Then there's all sorts of other startup costs and rules and regulations. And it seems like a really detailed process where things can go wrong, pretty easily. A lot of things that need to be done.
Absolutely. So we provided a term sheet or a commitment letter to the folks that we're financing that says that we'll finance them up to $250,000 in loans should they succeed in receiving a license from the state. And that's just one part of the financing. Obviously, that doesn't solve the full need, but the state is also providing $30 million in loans and grants to social equity applicants, to those who get licenses. So they will also have that to draw from. But, the cost to stand up a cannabis dispensary, it ranges pretty dramatically depending on where you are in the state. But if you're in some, a rural area of the state, maybe it'll cost you $750K. If you're in Chicago, maybe $1 million, $1.5 million. And so it'll require multiple investors to get them to the place where they can get their business up and running. But the main point is that the state has structured it in such a way that they don't have to raise that capital until after they've been awarded a license.
Really interesting sidebar on the recreational marijuana situation in Illinois. Thank you. Seeky Ballard is CEO of Good Tree Capital. He's joining us on Entrepreneur Friday. Coming up, seems like a lot of people kicked the tires last year.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
The automobile industry is topping off its sales figures for 2019, and it's looking like another great year. Let's talk with John McElroy, automotive industry analyst and host of Autoline.tv in Detroit. John, overall, pretty good numbers and a pretty good expectation for 2020.
You're absolutely right, Cisco. And the amazing thing is, all year long, the analysts were predicting that car sales were going to go down. It never happened. Sure, there was some fluctuations up and down during the year, but that's sort of normal. And once again, it sure looks like we don't have the final numbers, but the industry once again looks like it's topped 17 million units, 17 million new vehicles, 5 years in a row. That's never happened before.
And we don't see any of the blips like we've seen during natural disasters where you might have a surge in purchases and then a lull in purchases. This just pretty much seems like natural growth.
There is. And, look, the economy's pretty good. People have got jobs. Interest rates are low. You put all that together and it almost always equals a strong sales year for the automotive industry. And we've seen that happen here.
Trucks, SUVs, been very, very popular. Are we still seeing that or are they lagging at all?
No, not at all. It's passenger cars that continue to dip, although it looks like we might have hit bottom right now. They might go down a little bit more, passenger cars, but it looks like we might have hit bottom. So, if you go back 10 years ago, more than half of all new vehicles sold were passenger cars. Now it's about 1 out of 4.
And those are people, by and large, sort of worried about efficiency, maybe the commuters?
Well, it all depends. I mean, some people don't feel like they need to drive around in a big pickup truck. Other people do want more efficiency. Some just like the styling. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons why people buy different kinds of vehicles.
Let's talk about a few of the companies as they reported their fourth quarter numbers. GM and Fiat Chrysler both dipping in the fourth quarter.
They did. Well, you know, GM, that's no surprise whatsoever. You know, the company was on strike for a month, and even though dealers had a lot of inventory, GM took a dip. We don't have hard evidence on it, but it looks like some people just do not want to buy new cars from a company that's on strike. But, you know, once the strike was ended, GM put on maximum overtime, put on all kinds of sales incentives. They didn't quite catch it all back up, you know, but it looks like the strike cost them at least 50,000 new vehicle sales.
Always good analysis, John. Before we let you go, Fiat Chrysler, let's talk about them. What do you make of their dip?
Well, you know, they've got a lot of new product coming right now for 2020. That's what they really need. I mean, last year they really only had one all-new vehicle, the Jeep Gladiator, and that did fantastic. But this year they've got hybrid versions of Jeeps, plug-in hybrids of Jeeps coming. So it should, as long as sales hold up, and I'll point this out too, Cisco, I've noticed in the course of my career, new car sales never go down in a presidential election year. So we could be looking at a pretty good year if sales hold to history.
Really interesting. Really interesting. Thank you. John McElroy, an automotive industry analyst. He hosts Autoline.tv based in Detroit. If you missed any part of today's show, you can go to our stream and just rewind to the time you want. We have a pause and rewind function. It works both online and by updating the radio.com app. A podcast of the show will also be available at the radio.com app.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.